Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter, ensuring you won't miss a show release. You can also access more information on the topics covered, related recommendations, partnerships and collaborations that might appeal. You can follow us on all the social media platforms. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce our first sponsorship with Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. There is a Dutch seaside town whose unusual name is Scheveningen. And one of the curiosities of World War II is the Dutch used it as a code word because the Germans were unable to pronounce it correctly, thereby tricking German infiltrators into revealing their true identities. Well, my guest today doesn't come from Scheveningen, but he's Dutch, our first Dutchman. In fact, part Dutch, part Swedish, just to make an even more intriguing Northern European cocktail. Holland, home to Van Gogh, Johan Cruyff, and now Wim Hof, and Sweden, which has given us Alfred Nobel, Bjorn Borg, and Greta Thunberg. So with that as the backdrop, I'm thrilled to welcome our guest today, Martin Slenderbroek. Martin is currently chairman of Robeco, the Dutch investment powerhouse, former chief executive of Jupiter, and prior to that, member of the Global Operating Committee at BlackRock. Martin, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Many thanks, Simon. Well, I was born in Stockholm in Sweden. My father is actually Dutch and my mother Swedish. My father worked in the printing industry business. He was based up in Scandinavia, then relocated late 60s to Holland, and I came along. That was my first immigration experience because I arrived in that country in 1968, didn't speak a word of the language, and had to start school there. In a class of 42, one teacher, and I could only speak Swedish, they spoke Dutch. So that was a good founding experience to deal with these kind of situations later on in life. And after that, I lived until I was 25 in the Netherlands, went to university, studied law in Leiden, and ended up in London via a fairly interesting route. In a nutshell, my story, how I landed here. And I've been here more or less since 1987.
Let's pause on the University of Leiden. I read that William of Orange actually established it in 1575 after the town's heroic defense against the Spanish in the 80-year wars. Why did you choose that university and why law?
It is one of the studies in the Netherlands that is a little bit like history in the UK. It's a very broad education that readies you for all kinds of roles in business, but also in law. Leiden in Holland at the time was the preeminent university for law. So that was a relatively easy choice. Plus, the university system in the Netherlands is very different from here. It's not difficult to get in. It's difficult to stay in. So first year, 1,300 students in Leiden in law. Second year, 300 are left. Getting in was easy. Staying in was difficult, let's say.
Wow. I think maybe UK universities could learn a little bit about raising the bar for retaining your place. However, it's a different conversation. So then you moved to London and into financial services, I think, as an analyst. Tell me a little bit about that.
I was working as a legal assistant on the Amsterdam Stock Exchange in 1986. And I was helping a senior lawyer there to implement the first model code to prevent insider dealing. So this takes us back a little bit because at the time, you could insider deal as much as you like. And they did. So my job was to explain to people that the party is over and you got to sign this agreement with the stock exchange. That's now illegal and you go to jail. That went down like a lead balloon, but ultimately, of course, all of them did eventually sign up to this. Whilst I was doing that, I ran into an investment bank based in London called Enskilda Securities. And that was part of Skandinaviska Enskilda Banken. And I helped them with something completely unrelated. And it turned out I could speak Swedish, Dutch, and English. They called me up 3 months after I'd helped them with this particular matter and said, do you want to become an analyst in London? And I thought, what is an analyst? But then relatively quickly found out what that was. And I said, yes, I thought about it as an adventure, as something to do for a couple of years, age 25. And I'm still there.
And along the way, I think you have, it would be wrong to say you acquired a Finnish wife. You have a Finnish wife, only adding greater intrigue to this European cocktail, and three sons. So do tell me, what's the language at home?
The language at home is English. In Finland, there are two official languages. One is Finnish, the minority speaks Swedish. But she has actually lived here. Her father was a banker. She's lived in the UK since the late 70s. So our language at home is English, and my sons carry two passports, but are, for all intents and purposes, British, and maybe soon English.
Let's talk about this career path that takes you from Enskil to Merrill. So please, just let's peel the onion back on this interesting journey.
If you go back to the 1980s, that was a period of discovery of European markets. European markets were deeply under-researched. So one of the questions I used to ask company directors when I went to see them was, and when was the last time you saw an analyst? And the German would go, what is an analyst? This is good news, because you could actually add real value simply by writing up the story you heard, what the sort of basic valuation was, and get an idea of the position of that particular company in its industry. It was a period when I think analysts could add real value. And whether you worked at Enskil or Goldman Sachs, it was not very different, because it was a period of discovery. The names that led the market at the time were totally different. And yes, I ended up at Merrill Lynch, but that was via Smith Newcourt. I'd gone back for a little while to Holland and worked for a local broker there. But then Nicola Pease at Smith Newcourt called me up and said, why don't you come over here and become a Swiss analyst? I was ready to move back to London. And I'd meanwhile met my wife, who lived in London. So I thought, okay, we'll go and analyze Switzerland. So I ended up in Smith Newcourt, and that was taken over by Merrill Lynch. That's how I ended up there.
And then BlackRock acquires Merrill Lynch, and then you start to rise up the corporate ladder. And I'm intrigued because in our earlier conversation, you say that you worked very closely with Larry Fink, and one day after the financial crisis, you get a call with a request to look at troubled assets. Now, has interesting parallels perhaps today. Tell us about that.
Yes. So meanwhile, Merrill Lynch had acquired Mercury, and then that business, Merrill Lynch Investment Managers, was acquired by BlackRock. And that's how I ended up inside of BlackRock. In that financial crisis, many financial firms were like rabbits in the headlights. But Larry Fink had in BlackRock built up this platform called Aladdin. At the time, there were a number of third-party users of the platform, but we quickly realized that could be a very, very strong analytical tool to rapidly analyze large, complex portfolios of collateralized assets, which in the beginning of the crisis was the main focus. In Europe, there was very little in terms of infrastructure and people to do this. So I got the call to go and find pools of such assets where BlackRock could be helpful. And I rang the doorbell of the UK Treasury and effectively said, can we help with anything? And it was absolute chaos there, because they were struggling with banks, Lloyds, RBS, and others. At the time, it was totally unclear which banks would survive, what the bad bank would look like, and how to analyze all that. That, I think, for BlackRock's Aladdin business, was the very, very big break, because we ended up taking on the mandate to value and analyze all those assets, obviously in very close cooperation with the Treasury and the Bank of England with its various economic scenarios.
I'm intrigued if you think there are some parallels, because post the great financial crisis, American banks recapitalized widely and effectively UK banks perhaps the same. There's been this suggestion that European banks particularly have played more of what's called the extend and pretend game and haven't done such, probably explaining their standout valuations. So I wonder how you think about that currently.
In the United States at the time, the recapitalization was done faster and more forthright. And given the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, not doing anything was not an option any longer. So there was a real threat of going under. So people were looking very quickly to secure their equity financing, the stability of the firms. Whilst in Europe, there was more an expectation that governments would come in help these in companies. And that's exactly what happened. So if you lower interest rates to almost nothing, and you have sort of a government underwriting backstop, which we did in the UK as well, then, of course, you have companies that survive for a long time sitting on a large portfolio of either very difficult to value assets or very poor quality assets, but you can roll it forward through very cheap finance. That's the same for an individual who's sitting on a crazy high mortgage. If the interest rate is zero, you can carry that for many, many years.
I mean, I see there's been some private equity in the Greek financial services sector, which obviously was at the epicenter of that problem. But if you were wearing a different hat today as an investor, are you intrigued with the European financials? Or do you think that this maybe is more the Japanese parallel, multiple years of stock issuance and mergers and not a lot of value creation for shareholders?
I guess that everybody is tainted by the experience they've had. And I'll give you a little anecdote from those days back in 2008. What happened was that previous management in these banks either resigned or were fired by whoever took over control of these banks. Every time we came in to explain to these new boards what the portfolio looked like, we got the sort of request, shut all doors, send out all advisors, just the CEO and his closest lieutenants. Now, explain to me, what is a CDO? What is a CLO? It was that basic. And these were organizations that sat on billions of the stuff. So you have to ask yourselves, in these grand banks, hundreds and hundreds of billions of assets sit there. It's almost impossible, even for the best CEOs, to fully understand everything that's on the book. Therefore, I am with many other people in our industry. It's very difficult to value a bank. I can see the momentum in a bank. I can see what the interest curve does. But do I truly understand the hundreds of billions of assets and loans for a bank are assets, what the quality of those assets is, and can I make a judgment of whether I want to own a slug of that by being a shareholder in the company? I think the answer is no. But I get the point that, for example, UK banks are attractively priced in a historic context. And to answer your second question, really, I believe that we are closer to a Japanese scenario than some kind of strong recovery scenario.
Before we leave BlackRock, Larry Fink, we haven't had him on the show yet. Maybe we will in the future. What makes him so special? Because BlackRock clearly has been the winner out of almost amongst everyone in this last decade plus.
Larry Fink is a visionary in our industry. He has an enormously talented team around him. It's not just Larry. It's obviously a whole gang. But they've been together for many, many years. The platform the firm has built on, called Aladdin, allows them to operate very efficiently and manage huge quantities of assets. They have now, of course, built up enormous scale and operate at a level where, for many mandates, there will be no competitor or very few competitors on the planet Earth that can compete with them. So it is the runaway leader in our industry, and I don't think that that's going to change anytime soon.
So then you jump ship, become chief executive of Jupiter, one of the UK's premier asset management firms. And I wonder what the motivation was for that.
So at BlackRock, the opportunity for me was either to move to Asia or go and do something in the States. Larry was not willing to hand over the top job to me. and he's still in it. So that was a good decision. I got called up by Edward Bonham Carter. Basically, he had led Jupiter after a management buyout and had listed the company. But I guess that in 2011, the firm had arrived at the point where I'd say, now what? Now what are we going to do? So we started talking, and I felt that my experience both at Merrill and BlackRock were really, really relevant at that stage for Jupiter. So although it was a much smaller company, and the role I took on, although chief executive, it was much smaller than the responsibilities I'd had at BlackRock. But it was such an interesting opportunity and such a good company, Jupiter. So I jumped.
So let's talk about the asset management business. We had Martin Gilbert on the show a few months back, and he talked about the need for either specialization or scale. And there are lots of firms like Jupiter that sit, I think one could say, in the middle. I wonder how you think this plays out.
What you need in asset management is scale in product. You don't necessarily need to be BlackRock to be successful. There are firms with asset levels of less than 10 billion or maybe even 5 billion that can sort of motor on forever. Those are the typical boutiques. They are They run, for example, a value strategy with loyal clients and continue to do that forevermore. When you are listed, you are simply, as a result of the publicly traded stock, addicted to future growth. And then you have to play a different game. And firms like Jupiter are at the cusp of, shall we be a multi-boutique and allow those little cylinders to be standalone pieces, or are we going to become more of a global growth company competing, perhaps not with the likes of BlackRock, but more with, say, Amundi, companies that build the future on M&A?
You run a company like Jupiter, you have to manage portfolio managers. Now, I have managed portfolio managers. I think it'd be fair to say they can be mercurial. You also try to run a business strategically. How difficult is that?
I guess that is one of the most difficult things. I would compare it with any kind of knowledge business. I can imagine if you run a hospital and you have many erudite surgeons on your staff who know everything better than you do, or you run McKinsey with very clever consultants, you have this issue that you work with extremely intelligent people that have strong opinions about whatever you do in the firm. I find that stimulating and interesting. But if you're used to a legion of people that if you say step left, they all fall out left, then it's probably not your thing.
So let's talk about Robeco. You call yourselves the investment engineers. Robeco's been around for nearly 100 years, and it's one of the largest Dutch institutions. And interestingly, correct me if I'm wrong, but stated active manager. So why did you take this role? And tell us a little bit about Robeco.
Robeco stands for the Rotterdam Investment Consortium in Dutch. They were founded in 1929, just after that previous stock market crash. It was founded by a bunch of Rotterdam businessmen who felt that that was a good time to get into the investment game. And they were very, very right. When I grew up in the Netherlands, Robeco was almost a monopolist in the country. Robeco was almost considered an institution without equal. That's if you did investments, that's where your money typically went, an enormous market share. And what the firm has done in the last 15 or 20 years is totally reinvent itself under a number of leaders, but currently under Gilbert van Hassel, and have created a huge quant business, a very good active business, and all this under a sustainable investment philosophy. Robeco, in that perspective, is ahead of its time. Its position as a sustainable investor is clearly more advanced than almost all competitors I look at. And that's backed up by many, many years of deep and profound research into what sustainability means.
Well, we're going to come back to a few of those issues, but one question I'm curious about is Robeco is now owned by the Japanese. And I wonder, was that a fantastically shrewd acquisition? And if so, what is it that the Japanese give to Robeco?
The Japanese is a firm called Oryx, a firm that operates all over the world, in the United States, in Europe, and all over Asia. Robeco is one of its operating companies. It's a firm which owns firms like Boston Partners and many other firms in our industry. It is a family of asset management businesses. Robeco is by far the largest, but this is an area of growth for Oryx. In the Dutch structure, you do need a local board, a supervisory board, and you do need a chair for that board. Part of the role is to run that business and be accountable to the local regulator, but of course also understand what the interests are of the shareholder in Japan. That's one of the key reasons why I took this role, because I do and have worked many years with Japanese. I do understand the objectives and their way of doing business.
Let's come back to the key, in my mind, key things: active versus passive, quant versus orthodox, and growth versus value. So let's just start out. It's been easy to espouse the passive cause. Index investing has trumped so much active management in developed markets. We might be at the cusp of something else. Robeco's stated position is to believe in active asset management. I wonder whether you can flesh that out.
Active is that you believe that the market is inefficient. Robeco also has an index business. But that index business is largely built on sustainable investment indices. So it stays true to its colors and doesn't try to compete with straightforward index. But if you think about it, if you are a value investor, you go into the details of analyzing individual companies, and you do that very regularly, you end up being a semi-quant investor. You are looking at certain variables in many, many companies. I have over time seen many value investors that go more and more quant, if you like, because a lot of the research you're doing is simply quant. I just don't believe that it's active versus quant. It's active versus passive. And Rubico is clearly on the active side. There is also a huge market for passive index investing. Now, if you are a quant by heart, you're going to say, well, that's all very good as long as markets keep going up and you have an environment as we've had in the last 10 years. But there will also be times, and I believe currently is such a time, where you're better served by active investments.
Could we just maybe unpick this quant question? Because we have the firms, Winton, Oxford Asset Management, others who are driven by algorithms and essentially building machines to make predictions. But then there's a quant, which is different from that. It's using computing power to be able to essentially, if not replace analysts, support analytical frameworks. Is that right? And where are we going with those two camps?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you compare a fundamental only without any quant business, we'll typically have far fewer analysts than a quant business. So you need a huge amount of people doing quantitative research. You also need to have a deep understanding of what you're researching. Because if you happen to be a mathematician, surely you're good at the sort of theory of quantum investing. You also have to understand why you're dividing one thing by another or adding it up. And that is where the knowledge comes in of understanding what makes companies tick. And quantitative research is trying to look for what are the variables that tell me something about the future development of a firm. There is something called a small cap factor, a value factor, there's a momentum factor. Those are simply things that people, if you analyze it over time, those are factors, and that's sometimes called factor investing, that help you to predict the future of where the stock might go. That's obviously with lots of caveats, but that is what quantitative analysts typically try to do. Whilst the fundamental value analyst will not try to look for that. They stop once they've done all the fundamental research.
But you've been an analyst. Let us just pull an example here. You go to visit Ryanair and you go to visit British Airways, IAG. The quant will have told you so much, but sitting in that room, you start to make other judgments about vision, character. How do you think about that? Because presumably, as a former value investor and analyst, quant can only take you so far.
So quant investors would absolutely disagree with you because they're saying you must take away that human factor because that's where all your biases are going to get it wrong. Because, Simon, you'll meet somebody who loves skiing, has all the same interests as you have, and ultimately, you might like that investor. I think quant is saying, no, you have to be strictly rational. I, however, and in my career, I've been a fundamental value analyst, and I will definitely make a bet on good management teams. And in fact, sometimes you follow really good management teams around when they move from one firm to the other. You might even follow them because you believe in what they do. I think that is very different from quant analysis.
So let's come back to this ESG and sustainability. I was talking to Peter Harrison, who's the CEO of Schroders and has been on the show, and he's very complimentary about Rubico's initiative and work there. And I think Morningstar describes Rubico as a leader in the ESG field. And so I'm intrigued as to how it got to that position earlier than many, because everybody's talking about ESG and probably there's a lot more talk than there is really deep-seated proof of concept at some firms. Why has Rubico been so early and so committed?
First of all, you need a firm that has a vision to build something that isn't quite there yet. So that is being an early mover is important. And that is driven by demand. So if you contrast, for example, the UK market with many continental European markets, the demand for SI, sustainable investment philosophy investments, came later in the UK than it, for example, did in Norway or in Austria or in the Netherlands. So by catering for institutional investors on the European continent, I think to respond to the demands there, Rubico needed to build that up, but then really took that much further than many of its competitors. And therefore today have a very strong position with virtually all its assets under some kind of sustainable finance supervision.
And so what does this look like in a few years' time if there is widespread adoption? And I mean by that, how do firms differentiate themselves?
So the chief executive of Robeco is very clear. He sees this as a future without which you can't do. You will not be competing for assets in the institutional space without that capability. And therefore, every participant in the investment industry catering for large institutional investors is scrambling to get up to speed on sustainable investment and finance. There is also European regulation coming down the track. This is not just driven by commercial demands. There will also be regulatory demands in terms of reporting. Decarbonization, for example, is a huge topic for all kinds of publicly owned large investment portfolios. And if you start that game today, you're never going to catch up. So I believe that Robeco indeed is in a strong position to continue to grow its footprint, particularly in that space.
So just broadening the conversation, we have this abnormal world of zero nominal rates, effectively negative real rates. As you look around the world, what are the asset categories that excite you as an investor?
One of the most difficult things to explain to people at the moment, when somebody says to me, I'm a conservative investor, you know, I'm happy just a steady 5% and I will never complain. And you go, yes, yes, that's all very good, but interest rates are zero to negative. So that's not going to work. You are living in a very difficult time to get those easy returns. You have to constantly look at where the opportunities exist. And, you know, speaking my own book, I like the UK. I like the UK for a number of reasons. It's completely out of favor. Valuations are on the floor. Add to that the Brexit and the COVID situation. You end up with the margin of safety. You end up with a really attractive valuation. And even if you get it half wrong, you're not probably going to lose money. 2 months ago, I looked at investment trusts in the UK, real estate investment trusts, and I invested in five of them, helped by a very shrewd investor called Simon Cook, who knows this industry inside out. He runs a firm called APAM. And together we came up, where are the largest discounts to NAV? Where are good management teams? Where is the portfolio less exposed to, let's say, retail and more to other areas? There are real opportunities out there all the time. But today, the easy ride of just having a portfolio of credits yielding 7% with inflation running at 2%, it doesn't exist. That game, sadly, is over because it was good.
Well, there may be a danger of confirmation bias, but I too am a big fan of the investment opportunity available in the UK market, and I've been investing more there over recent months. It was interesting, Graham Secker, who is Morgan Stanley's European strategist, recently wrote, UK equities are very cheap versus their peers and very positively correlated to global value trends. And he went on to say, the UK equity market is arguably the cheapest major stock market in the world following years of persistent underperformance. With valuations and positioning depressed, the UK's relative performance is close to a 50-year low. Along the way, you've managed and worked alongside all sorts of money managers, and I was wondering, are there one or two that have particularly struck you in what, after all, is a business where somebody once quipped, successful investing is a minority sport?
If I would pick out one person that I've looked at over the years, and I don't know him person, but you can read his books, is Joel Greenblatt. He's written this absolutely marvelously titled book, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius Too. And really anything by Joel Greenblatt is worthwhile reading. He's a true value investor. He's looking for undervalued situations. And if you think what he says in that book, when there is a merger, there is a spin-off, there's a restructuring, often kind of funky little securities are issued that are just issued to make up a deal. And this is rounding errors. They're typically small. They're typically overlooked. They're typically underanalyzed. And they're often mispriced. That is where amateur investors really can make very big returns if they do their homework and work very hard at it.
And of course, over those years, you have been an investor yourself. Tell me about your best investment.
If I'd pick out one name that over many, many years had made fabulous returns for me, it's probably L'Oreal. L'Oreal is now a very big company. If you follow that stock over the years, it is just phenomenally defensive. The products obviously cater for the beauty industry. That is an industry with lots of innovation. They're always at the forefront of that. They got lots of leading brand names. It's always been well managed. It had a controlling shareholder for many years. Now gone, but nevertheless, it is just a company that's through thick and thin over the years has produced stellar returns. And I've been in it for a long, long time. The other end of the spectrum, when the pandemic hit in March,
I saw a lot of stocks going down. Everything went down, including the likes of PayPal and Amazon. And I said to myself, I've never owned these stocks. I've always thought them too expensive. They're probably too expensive anyway. But I couldn't see any rationale why I would sell Amazon on the back of that pandemic where people would have to sit at home and self-isolate. So I did buy both of those, and in fact, recently sold them again. But that is not typically the type of investment I made, but the returns have just been extraordinary.
Let's just talk a little bit about books. I know you're a voracious reader. You already referred to Joel Greenblatt's books, but two books, two different topics. What are your two favorite reads?
So I think anybody who has got an interest, whether you are a value investor or not, or you don't know where you are, you must read Benjamin Graham's The Intelligent Investor. That is, alongside Security Analysis, of course, a starting point for anybody who wants to do anything in this business, either as an amateur or as a professional investor. So if I would talk about something different, I would single out particularly history and biography books. And the most recent one I've read is the stunning biography on John F. Kennedy, JFK. There's only one volume out of two out at the moment, by a guy called Loswell of the Kennedy School of Harvard. And that is a terrific read.
So we started earlier on talking about Leyden and its defense against the Spanish in the 80-year war. As we look at the European situation and all of the fault lines that still exist, is your view a future of greater federation or of more separation?
So first of all, I'm half Dutch, half Swedish. So I'll declare colors here. I'm a European federalist. I absolutely have a problem with nationalism, whether that's little Englanders or little Dutchmen or little Frenchmen. That's not where I'm coming from. So a European federation I see as a good thing. That doesn't forever mean that nationalities will disappear. Even in a country like Holland or Sweden or in Hungary, there are groups of people that speak a different language and have done so for 1,000 years. It hasn't changed. The borders don't influence that. But the future for me is definitely a more federal, more integrated Europe. That's going to be slowly the direction of travel for the European Union ex-UK.
So let's talk about one of your other ventures, which is that you're involved in the fintech world, which will definitely cross borders. And you are involved in this company called Mintos, which I understand is working on exchange-traded fractional ownership. Fascinating. So please tell us a little bit about it.
This is a business set up by a friend of mine called Tamer Osman, who originally is Turkish but lives here in London. He is a former Microsoft executive. With his team, they have built up a distributed ledger platform, say blockchain to simplify it. Instead of trying to trade some kind of virtual currency or others, we are looking, how can you apply this in the real world? And the conclusion we come up with is that if you look how non-securitized assets are traded, for example, real estate, through a distributed ledger platform, you can fractionalize a building, let's say an Amazon warehouse, and sell it piecemeal to institutional or high net worth individuals, or in a longer term future to small investors. They really want to zoom in on one particular category, in this case, distribution centers, just to name something that is popular at the moment. And this is obviously no investment advice, because your return on distribution centers, I've found out, is virtually nil. Well, 3%. But nevertheless, that's what we do. That could also be wine, aircraft, it could be any kind of illiquid assets. Really, what we try to do in the end with Mintos is to build a global marketplace for illiquid assets. And we're going to do that through an FCA regulated firm that everybody can deal with a great degree of trust, that it's the assets have been checked for quality, that there is rigid oversight, huge due diligence on everything that we take on board.
That's fascinating. Well, we'll watch that space with great interest. Changing tack, you serve on the board of trustees of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. Tell us about that.
Jupiter was for many years a sponsor of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. And this dates back to the time of John Duffield, the founder of Jupiter originally. And when I took over from him, I continued that. But also in a personal capacity, I think what the orchestra does is phenomenal. This is a time where I believe that the arts and culture needs support. Governments have many other fish to fry, but I think life is enriched by music. One of the beautiful things of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment is not just Baroque, but the idea is that you play original music scores as they were written at the time, performed, where possible, with the instruments of the time. And that is such a magical thing. So if you ever get the opportunity, just to plug this, look at the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment on YouTube. It is fantastic. And even better, when we're allowed again, come down to the South Bank and see a performance. It's a truly outstanding orchestra. And like any other cultural institution, is in need of our support.
A few more general questions. When you have met with an obstacle or a disappointment in your life, how have you overcome it?
I come from a family of entrepreneurs. So my father was somebody who overcame huge setbacks, fundamental shifts in industry. And I believe that through time, if you've had experience enough and you've seen many rapid changes, huge obstacles, the more often you see them, the better equipped you are to deal with them. And I was fortunate enough to be grown up in a family where I'd seen that right from the off, from home. I worry a little bit about the current, dare I say, snowflake generation. If you're too mollycoddled and everything that is done to you is somebody else's fault and the government needs to indemnify you or somebody else needs to pay for it, it creates a whole generation where those setbacks will take a huge mental toll. And I don't really know what to do about this because in a one way, you know, being bullied at school is a bad thing. At the same time, if you're always mollycoddled in your life and you are then faced with a situation that is uncomfortable and difficult, can you deal with it? I really don't know what the answer is. And I'm not saying that one thing is better than the other, but dealing with obstacles, setbacks, crisis, it helps if you've dealt with them before. Very much so.
And so what advice would you give to a student thinking about their career?
So my biggest advice to people, if you have an interest, if there is something you love to do, follow that. Go for it. But many of the children that I know or young grown-ups up to the age of 25 or so, they don't really have that true calling. And to those, I would say, have an open mind. Try something. Don't wait for whatever is perfection to come to you. Go for something. And it could literally be anything. If you are committed, hardworking, and interested in what you do, you will advance in whatever organization you are. So my advice to young people is don't get hung up what your parents did, that you don't have a true calling. You might not want to become a doctor or an investment professional, but try something. Try more things. Have an open mind.
You have three sons. Would you encourage them to look at finance if they thought they were motivated by that?
Absolutely. Both my wife and I are financial analysts by training. So I have two sons who couldn't be bothered even to talk to me about finance because they're really not interested in that. And I have a third son, my youngest, who seems very interested. What you don't want to do is to push your children into something that is not their thing. And particularly, Simon, if you think back to the 1980s and early 90s, if you went into investment banking, that was a pretty tough old school of hard knocks, working 6-7 days a week, 12, 14 hours a day. The answer to whatever the question your boss asked was yes. I don't think it's for everybody. And there are many other fields that I believe young people can proceed in. And, you know, we talked a little bit about Rubico and sustainable investing. That's an area where a lot of young people are interested. That is more about if you own companies, what can you do with those ownership rights? Can you influence the world with those voting rights for the good? And I think that is a really attractive avenue for many young people.
Well, for young people listening and parents of young people listening, the Money Maze podcast is just launching an ambassador program. So people who are interested in maybe take on that role while they're at university can go to our website, themoneymazepodcast.com, and find more about that. Who's inspired you most to date?
I have been very lucky. I worked with phenomenally interesting people over the years. And in the old days, when you got into this industry, you had to be a little bit lucky. You had to sit next to somebody who was good at what they did. It wasn't like a class of analyst. You really have to learn on the job. And I had the luck. And in both cases, there were women. So at Enskill, there was a lady called Diana Barron who worked me day and night. And that was a good thing. At Smith Newcourt, it was Nicola Pease. And I think that you come across Basil Poston at Morgan Grenfell. These are people who I learned enormous amount from. And that sort of set me up for a career at the time, I thought, in financial analysis. You know, there are many people. I should perhaps also mention Rob Fairbairn, who took the initiative to yank me out of Merrill Lynch Investment Bank into Merrill Lynch Investment Managers. Without that transaction, I wouldn't have had the jobs I've had.
Slightly different. I know you love skiing, and one of the Money Maze podcast fans, a gentleman we both know called Dean Pennick, tells me you're extremely accomplished. And I wondered if you could choose two people outside of the world of finance to spend a day skiing with in the French Alps, who they might be.
Well, my favorite, and this will not surprise you, and he was the best interviewer on the planet, was Ingemar Stenmark. Ingemar Stenmark is the world's best slalom skier of all time, I would argue. He came from a tiny little village at the end of a dead-end road, deep in the wilderness of Sweden, close to the Norwegian border, speaking in a very heavily accented local dialect. And the interviewers would make fun of him by asking him very long-winded questions, and his answers would be yes. Or no. You know, I would sort of compare him to a Yorkshireman in this country. Absolutely no frivolity whatsoever. That is the man I'd love to ski with. The other person I'd love to meet, although he's actually sadly passed away, but is Reinhold Messner, the man who I think ran up Mount Everest without oxygen endless amounts of times. Probably the world's preeminent climber. That is a fascinating man.
I heard him talk at the Royal Geographic Society, and his closing words were, at the end of your life, it's not what you have that matters, it's what you have done.
Yes, yes. By the way, he is one of those people that you hear the name and you think he's a German. But of course, he's Italian, coming from that German-speaking part of Italy. One of the more fascinating aspects of that whole European continent.
Your other great passion is wine. So a different question. On a cold winter Sunday with a slow-cooked joint of lamb, what's the red wine that you're going to drink? And on a warm, post-COVID, sunny June evening with some grilled sea bass caught amicably in the post-Brexit English Channel, what's the white wine you're going to drink?
In cold weather, it would be a Pomerol. And of course, Pomerols, you can invest any kind of money. But I would say a really, really nice red wine would be a Rouget. And I would go for 2009-10. It's still reasonably affordable, fantastic. I have a place in Le Prat that sits in the Travelay ski area. But if I can choose, and there's a restaurant there called the Soucoupe, and the sommelier is called Robin. Wine you need to ask for on a sunny day is Schist. It's a local wine, S-C-H-I-S-T-E. It's an outstanding white wine from the Savoie region.
East Savoie region. Okay, I've written that down, Martin. That's fantastic. Well, I am going to ask you one final question and let you go. And that's, if you could tell our listeners just one thing.
I would say to the younger people that it is impossible to predict what you're going to do in life. And have an open mind. Let things come to you. When you are young and you get opportunities to do something that you find interesting and perhaps not exactly what you thought, go for it. That's what I would say to you.
Fantastic. That's great, clear, unambiguous advice. Martin, it's been a terrific pleasure to have this conversation with you today. Thank you very much indeed.
Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.